Okay, so welcome to the next episode of Pegasus Radio. And today, this is a bit of a special one for me in the Meet the Boss series. I started recruiting in the cost consultancy world in 1999. And the person I'm about to speak to was probably one of my first 10 placements, which I think is quite special. And he's gone on to do amazing things. And I think this is going to be a real lesson to all young QSs out there about what they can achieve in their career. So today I am meeting Simon Light. Simon, welcome.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good to see you. And it does feel like not too long ago since we last saw each other, but also when we met in 1999.
Yes.
I think about this the other day, actually. That's when we used digitizers. Do you remember?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Funnily enough, I interviewed somebody else on a podcast a little while ago who's certainly, you know, what might be saying is he's in his 60s now. And he was talking me through the QS journey about all the different things they used. And yes. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great. No, well, thanks very much for having me and looking forward to this conversation.
No, perfect. So Simon, if we just maybe start by, I guess, very briefly going over your current role in terms of what you do, but then we're going to kind of go down memory lane. I'm quite keen for people to understand your story, because I do think you've achieved an awful lot in your career. So I think that's what youngsters will be keen to hear this story.
Yeah, great. So my current role is that I'm Executive Managing Director for a company called GHD. GHD are an Australian legacy firm of about 11,000 people doing multidisciplinary type of services, whether it's engineering, architecture, quantity surveying, program management, environmental services, energy solutions, etc. And so my role is to look after Europe, Middle East, Africa. So I sit on the group executive of that business. I've been with them for the last 2 years, about having had a much kind of longer career, a business called EC Harris and Arcadis, and I'll come on to that in due course. But if I just to kind of just give you a quick flavor of me personally as well, if that may help, Paul. Yes, I'm originally from Scotland, but I suppose I've got that kind of strange mix of my dad is from Yorkshire, like yourself, Paul.
Yeah.
And my mum's from Dundee. So I definitely kind of take kind of the maternal side in terms of my loyalties to kind of a country. But yeah, for me personally, I come from a family of six people where my dad was a headmaster for many years of his career. Mum was a nurse. And we were brought up actually kind of with fairly strong family values, but also that sense of being pushed to get out and try stuff and do stuff, experience new things. And it's something that kind of has really kind of stuck with me throughout my days since we met in 99 and then over the last kind of 21 years as well. And where I've kind of got to, I suppose, over the years is that sense of what feels important to me. And I do go back to my family values, how they were kind of instilled in me in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I went to a school called Sebra School, which is just in the Lake District. Which is very famous for its sport and music. So I kind of excelled in that space. And I suppose I got enough kind of academic qualifications to move into kind of university.
Right.
And that's when I went to university at Robert Gordon's up in Aberdeen and ended up finishing at Napier University in Edinburgh when I got my kind of BSc Hons in quantity surveying.
And what made you go into that, Simon? What made you pick quantity surveying?
Well, I initially didn't pick quantity surveying. Okay. I initially went up to Robert Gordon's to look at architecture and building surveying. But that was in 93. At that stage, the country was in fairly difficult times. Mm. And the courses were actually together. So we were with the Gray School of Art up in Aberdeen, which is the architecture school, as well as the building surveyors, as well as the construction management folk and the QSs. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the QSs were in pretty high demand. And particularly up in Aberdeen, actually, which is kind of obviously an oil capital.
Yes.
There's no shortage of work. Mm. I also found that just for me personally, the QS course, the QS elements there just appealed to me a bit more, actually. So got the kind of the real strength in the building economics and the technical capability. But actually the commercial side and the management side appealed to my upbringing and my background. And so that's kind of where I moved through. And I was fortunate enough, I was playing a lot of rugby at the time down in Edinburgh. So I was up and down between Aberdeen and Edinburgh a lot.
Right.
And I was fortunate enough to get a placement year in the sandwich course with a company called CBA, Copland Associates. And so worked with them throughout that and indeed during my final year at uni. And they took me on afterwards on a kind of full-time employment basis.
Right, brilliant. Excellent. And what kind of things did you work on initially when you were in Edinburgh?
Now we go back on this. quite a wide range. And actually, I do go back to it as being just a great period of building that strong technical discipline and knowledge. I'll be the first to admit, Paul, that I'm not the world's best QS, right? But actually, that time period was really important for me to get that strong base. So working projects like quick fit rollout programs, like community centres in the less desirable spots in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. Worked on an amazing building, a Charles Murray McIntosh building in Glasgow called the Lighthouse, which unfortunately burnt down 2-3 years ago.
Oh, yes.
And a building called the Tun, which was built just above the road leading up to Scottish Parliament. Okay. So I was getting a good blend of small projects, complex, kind of fairly architecturally important projects.
Okay.
But it just gave me the absolute discipline to understand actually kind of how buildings work. But also in relating how does it all stitch together in terms of the design, the program, the cost, and actually how you get that really important link between cost and value.
Yeah, perfect. Okay. And how many years were you there, Simon, before you made the move down to Leeds when we and you first met?
Yeah, so they took me through chartership. So I got through my APC at that time, which I'm sure was much harder in those days than it is now.
That's what I say, definitely, yes.
That's what I say, always say. I managed to avoid the old TBC, actually, which I think was a written exam.
Right,
so
okay.
I didn't have to do that. And so I was with them post-qualification for 2 years. And that's kind of when you and I met, actually. Mm. And I'm thankful to this day, Paul, of that sort of opening that you gave me to join EC Harris.
Yes.
That was a decision to, sort of, I suppose, properly emigrate from Scotland down to Leeds on a day where there was a big fuel crisis. And so got down to Leeds with EC Harris and immediately started work on the Bradford Schools Reorganisation Programme.
Right.
That was an amazing year, actually, there, because to this day, I'm still in contact with a lot of people who were working for Boris Len Lees, for EC Harris, for all the designers. And it was definitely kind of a program of work which was ahead of its time in terms of the procurement techniques. And so I stayed there for a year. Lynn, my girlfriend at the time, and I, we'd always had this kind of urge to head overseas, to experience new culture, to experience some new ways of working, get a bit of cash in the back of our pocket and return back to UK. And so one of the reasons for being so excited about joining EC Harris was they had those international opportunities.
Yes.
And so after a year, I left them to go to Dubai. Mm-hmm. And it was a week before 9/11 that we landed there.
Right.
And so we had the whole experience of going into new culture, obviously in a country which was going through quite a significant turmoil.
Yes.
But it was right at the beginning of the major boom that...
Yes.
A lot of people and your listeners would have seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with the initial idea of going out there for 2 to 3 years, we just found a spot there where, from a career perspective, I just had an amazing opportunity to work on the world's biggest, most complex schemes. And for me personally, to kind of go through lots of different experiences of initial quantity surveying into team management, into leadership, getting the spiky point of sales, diversifying businesses as you go through that journey. But reflecting back on that time, when I arrived there, we had a team of 10. Mm. And when got to the peak, we were just over 600 people.
Yes.
And so dramatic growth from a standing start.
Over what kind of time scale was that, Simon, if you recall? How many years would you say?
Yeah, that was over 6 years.
Wow, which is phenomenal growth, isn't it, in 6 years?
And yeah, it was.
The challenges that come with that, you know, change management, all the things that come with that.
Yeah,
different business, isn't it, from 10 people to you know, a proper organisation of 600 and the HR issues, management issues, everything that comes with that. It must have been quite a challenge. What did you learn over that period in terms of managing and growing and scaling very quickly?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's so important to be market-led and client-led in what you do. And so the build and they will come strategy is something that we wanted to avoid at all costs. And so it was client pull. We also wanted to make sure that we were very clear in terms of the premium nature of what we do. Mm-hmm. And so that attracted the right quality of people to come and join or indeed transfer across to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But that actually kind of when we were playing that back to our clients, they saw it. So it wasn't just talk. They saw the top quarter of people that were coming in.
Right.
We're also very selective with who we chose to work with.
Okay.
And so it wasn't just about trying to shoot for everything at that time, but being selective on the programs and the type of clients who value what we did, actually. Yes. And just looking back on that, the retention rates that we had were amazing. And it was in a market where people could move for more money at the time to go to work client side or to go to competitors who are trying to come in. Mm-hmm. But actually, we had consistently, our retention rates were above 95%. And so we worked quite hard on the culture of the firm that we're seeking to create. And with the ability to reach back into, at that stage, is a very strong UK base that ECI has had.
Yeah.
And so had some kind of world leading expertise, knowledge to be able to apply to that emerging market.
Mm. Okay, excellent. And would you say there are any mistakes you went over? I'm sure there were some mistakes, but you know, what would you say were some of the biggest lessons, you know, positive or negative, that you learned from that time over in the Middle East? And like you say, it was a difficult market. Obviously, it's renowned for very challenging clients, and it may be that you picked the right clients, I guess, to work with, and getting paid, just simple things like that was a challenge, I believe, in the UAE. Yeah, repeating again, going from 10 to 600, there must be some real lessons there, good and bad, that you learn about what to do and not to do to grow a business.
That's right. I think certainly as a growing business, it is so important that you get your service quality right. Mm. And you really do lead through a very strong lens of client care. And so the almost overinvestment in those early days, actually, of getting tight to clients, building the relationships and the networks, was crucially important. And also extremely enjoyable, I would say, as well. Getting to learn about new people coming from all different types of backgrounds. It was it was fantastic. I think also for when we do go into kind of new markets and experience different cultures, there's always an unconscious or even conscious bias that we carry in the way that business is done. And of course, business is not done in the same way that we do it here in the UK all the time, different parts of the world. And so going through those experiences where there's a slight tension built, perhaps actually in a project issue or in the way that business is done, it's just learning to get through that and actually to put your own self into the minds of the person that you're trying to do business with, how are they actually perceiving you? And certainly in that part of the world, there's always been a strong case of a relatively kind of high degree of paranoia around international people coming in to basically just take lots of money and to be quite self-serving.
Right.
And so to break down those kind of barriers of mistrust is something that we had to kind of develop through experience, go through the highs and lows. There was a huge piece clearly that we learnt about when Dubai kind of experienced some major kind of changes in the global financial crisis in 2008. And I think looking back on that, we did sort of overstretch ourselves on some major schemes and perhaps actually got a little bit complacent.
Okay.
And it was going so well, and to kind of have that scale from 10 to 600 people in six years.
Yeah.
Without kind of the really robust operational systems that back you up, taking that kind of proper risk management approach to things, you can get carried away. And so what that led to for us actually was a fairly awkward period of making sure that we actually got paid. We managed to maintain as many jobs as we could during a time when the whole world went into crisis. But what I think I would take from that whole experience actually, which is a very nasty experience that nobody wants to go through in their career.
It's poignant right now, I guess.
It is, but treating people with respect in everything that you do, making sure that actually, first and foremost, you're taking care of the health, welfare, and safety of people. And in that occasion, as you can imagine, it was actually sending people not just away from a job, but they had to kind of leave the country and go back to their home markets, where it was in Australia, South Africa, UK, America, where the world was in a bit of turmoil as well. So, a strong lesson that we all take away actually of when you go through major recessions, there's actually perhaps kind of one of the biggest learning experiences you can have as well.
Mm. Undoubtedly, yeah. Okay. So when did you return to the UK? What stage was that? That was and was that still EC Harris at the time, or was that Arcadis by that point?
It was EC Harris just. So it was in May 2011 that we came back with our two daughters who were born in Dubai.
Okay.
And that's where I led the UK property business. So it was the jewel in the crown for EC Harris. And it was it's one of those kind of amazing times when I came back from Dubai when literally the world is pretty much on its knees actually at that stage. And you saw the power of a global city of London.
Yes.
But you also saw the power of a very focused approach business in terms of where they choose to play and how they develop a quite significant and differentiating proposition.
Yes.
And so the period actually from 2011 through to about 2014 was another kind of great learning experience for me, actually, where we saw major growth in the London market, which obviously had the Olympics, a lot of expenditure, overseas expenditure coming into the likes of the residential and commercial property areas and so on.
Yeah.
And it was during that time, as you mentioned there, Paul, that EC Harris, partnership chose to sell to Arcadis, the PLC. And a seminal moment, I think, for not just the EC Harris business, but for the industry. And we'd seen the example of Davis Langdon selling to Aecon. Mm. And so at that stage, I was very heavily involved in the integration of EC Harris and Arcadis. Mm. When actually in the UK, there's, albeit that Arcadis is a much, much bigger organization worldwide, in the UK, they're very small. And so getting that dynamic right and to drive successful acquisition tactics was important.
Yeah, yeah.
So a really interesting time.
Yeah. And so if you recall at the time, what was the driver, would you say, with the partners of EC Harris to be acquired from obviously what was a very proud business, which had a long history behind it. And I guess EC Harris as a business has been trading for years and years prior to that. So what was the thought process at the time? Obviously, like you say, Davis Langdon did it, others did it. But I tend to feel that, and maybe this is another question, EC Harris and Arcadis did a much better job of merging than perhaps other businesses who'd merged recently did at the time, I think.
Yeah. As a group of partners back in those days, there's a recognition that actually we need to get more capital into the organization for us to really achieve the ambition for not just growth, but actually relevance. And so not long before 2011, Built Asset Consultancy had been launched by EC Harris. And that was really a message out to the market that we're more than quantity surveyors or project managers. Actually, the whole aspect of outcome-based consultancy is much more valuable into the industry rather than perhaps a single commoditized service.
Okay.
And so that shift had happened, and we felt that actually we were getting more pull from a number of multinational clients. And so to do that, you need obviously investment to help you set up that infrastructure, new people coming into the business, new types of skill sets as well. And so the options come up of do you go to a bank? You try and get some private equity. Mm. Both of those are knocked out quite quickly because we wanted to make sure that we actually maintain a strong degree of self-determination. The other option was to sell off to somebody who's actually of a completely different nature and get the cash in, but again, lose control of the business.
Yes.
Or do you merge with a company who carries similar interests and the view of where the market needs to be in due course? Mm. And so that's where there were a number of other suitors who were looked at the time, and Arcadis was the one that was decided.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And I'll say without necessarily stripping apart what other businesses did, because you were dealing with EC Harris and Arcadis, but I did sense that as a merging of businesses, you did a better job perhaps than a lot of others did around the same kind of time. Do you think there's any reasons for that? Was that cultural alignment? What was it? What made it work well, I guess?
Yeah, I think a number of things I've probably called out, Paul. I've been now involved in four or five different acquisitions. Mm. And that one particularly in the kind of first 2 years went very, very well. And the main reason for me actually was, and actually for any acquisitions, having a clear idea of what is the 1+1=3 is really important. So not 1+1=2, which is just basically building scale and perhaps more of the same thing.
Okay, yeah.
But the plus one is what is the different sort of bit that you're looking to create out of the marketplace that clients will buy and which will be additive to both organizations and to the market as well. Mm. And so that was very quickly identified, actually, that with the technical skills and the client access that Arcadis has brought, with the quantity surveying, the program management consulting element that EC Harris brought together, actually that was a very strong proposition.
Okay, awesome.
And so with a very strong focus towards market, actually by doing that, we're able to gain momentum in terms of revenue growth, but also create some case studies and success that create the followership, the whole business to get behind it.
Yeah.
From a cultural perspective, we were coming from very different points. Partnership culture is very different to PLC culture. And then you start looking at the different cultures between nationalities, between the Brits and the Dutch in this case, and a lot of kind of other kind of European and American colleagues as well.
Yes.
And I think for all acquisitions, actually, you'll get a good reading of whether the cultures are close enough.
Yes.
To get that to work.
Okay.
Because you won't get any two businesses that are 100% aligned on culture.
Sure.
But certainly kind of recognizing where those differences are and how do you kind of work together to resolve them was important. And I think also the fact that a lot of kind of the senior people within ECI House were given very senior roles within Arcadis to help drive the broader business transformation.
Yes.
So Arcadis at that time were very much on that transformation journey themselves.
Okay.
And it was felt that, ECI House leadership and management had a very strong role to play to drive that program.
Brilliant. Okay, excellent. And so you obviously remained on. You obviously went on to do different roles, I guess, within Arcadis fundamentally. Just talk us through that, Simon, and then I guess what made you reach the point that you chose to leave?
Yeah, so as I said before, actually, it was 18 years that I was together with ECI House and Arcadis.
Yeah.
And so after the merger or the acquisition, really, it was, they gave us money, we didn't give them money. It's so I led the UK property business for the combined entity up to about 2014. Mm-hmm. In 2014, I was then plucked out, actually, to lead the integration of the next major acquisition, which was Haida Consulting into Arcadis. So about 8,000 people worldwide, spreading from Tasmania through to Germany, through to Asia and the UK. And just a fascinating experience to have gone through, a proper leap into the unknown for myself at the time.
Okay.
And so I did that for a year. And then I came back onto the UK leadership team.
Okay.
To basically, I suppose the challenge given to me was finish what you started in terms of getting these businesses to really work together towards growth, a synergistic fit. And so, I did that for 2-3 years. And then my role actually got extended to leading across Europe, Middle East, and the UK, which is about 13,000 people, 18 countries, as many different languages and cultures. And that at that stage, my accountability on the board is very much around client development, brand, marketing, and client experience.
Okay.
So I was very heavily involved in the rebranding of Arcadis. Mm-hmm. That was the shrinking of essentially 16 brands into one.
Right.
Which, so you've got that culture experience program to go through as well.
Yeah.
And then the activation of that over the following years. So a really exciting period actually. So by kind of 2019, and having been at the business for 18 years, I felt actually time for me to do something different. And that's when I started looking at various options, actually. And I got very heavily involved in the innovation and particularly digital innovation side of things. And I came through as a real passion of mine.
Mm.
So do I kind of head off and do something like that in a startup capacity? Do I go out by myself, actually?
Mm.
Do something like that? Do I jump into another PLC type business? Or do I actually look at something which is perhaps a bit smaller in scale, is about to start that sort of transformation journey that I can sort of bring my experience and excitement to as well?
Yeah.
So that's when JHD came across.
Okay. Great. Okay. And I presume you had a lot of opportunities beyond JHD at the time. What I'm sure you must have had a lot of suitors. What made you go to JHD as opposed to, perhaps others that you had, as you said, because it was, a new challenge, but anything else in particular that, like you say, after 18 years at Arcadis ECI House, what made you?
Yeah, I think one of the kind of things that I was looking for and indeed reflect on today, actually, is I've managed to kind of work in different types of organization, in a small limited company into a medium scale partnership.
Yeah.
Into a large multinational PLC firm. And each of those have got their pros and cons. And there are very different ways that those types of organizations will do business, how they operate, how they drive their culture, their client value propositions, their employee value propositions, and so on. And I felt actually that for me, that the values that more sort of partnership or employee-owned type organizations have, they fit more well with me personally. Okay. And so that was a very strong pull for me towards JHD, which is a 100% employee-owned firm.
Okay.
And it provides actually the opportunity to really drive that agility in innovation, in trying new ideas, in in actually pivoting to go towards different areas in the investment choices that a business is able to make, rather than perhaps being at the mercy of external shareholders that PLC firms have. And so kind of with the was the background that I had as a partner of EC House for many, many years, that's something that it just fitted very well with me. And one which actually allows us to really drive that really, I think, really important aspect of innovation, entrepreneurialism that's so important in our industry today. But also in the context of a highly successful business, which is actually ready to invest in some new areas and really give it a go.
Yeah, okay, awesome, perfect. And that probably brings us nicely actually onto, I guess, one of the next questions, which was, how do you feel technology and the whole digital piece is going to change things? And I know that's, you know, part of what you're doing at GHD and leading that, and obviously you say it's a passion of yours anyway. How do you think, I guess, the construction, but also the wider infrastructure market, how do you think that's going to change over time because of technology, and how will technology play a part in all of that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Paul. There's no doubt in my mind that there are many, many issues that the world is facing right now in the natural and built environment, that the demand for solutions and next generation solutions is going to be undiminished of delivering client outcomes and community benefit as well.
Okay.
If you just look at the history of the industry, we've had to innovate a lot over the kind of past decades. I joked earlier about the digitizers. As just one area, but look how far we've come since then. But also that real sort of sense and importance of analytics, of making sure that we've got right kind of data-led solutions, the right technical solutions to bring forward, is critically important. Now, how that data gets applied, of course, is the big ask. And I think the ability for us to understand the valued requirements of our clients, or indeed actually help shape those solutions through the use of data and through use of strong technical services. I think there's our opportunity, and there's already some great, great examples where platform solutions are being brought in, but actually data just by itself isn't particularly valuable. Data kind of with an identified job to be done, and indeed sort of an identified sort of valid outcome to deliver as well is really important. I do come back to actually there's a great academic called Clayton Christensen.
Okay.
He's got a quote which is along the lines of, if you're sat on the leadership team of a consultancy, just consider that, are you moving at least as fast as your fastest moving customer?
Okay.
Because if you're not, the end is nigh. And so I think for us and as an industry, I think there is our challenge. But personally, Paul, I do believe that the pace of change that we are feeling right now is probably not going to be as slow as it is right now over the next 20 years.
So you think that will increase exponentially then in terms of pace of change?
I do. I think we've already seen some of the major shifts that have happened since the beginning of COVID. So new alternative ways of working, new ways of working. And perhaps actually this is the opportunity for the whole industry to accept a number of the great ideas that have already been put into place in the previous years, but perhaps haven't been accepted at scale yet. So I do believe that we've got an industry-wide opportunity at this time.
Okay, perfect. Okay, no, that is really interesting, Simon. And I think it's fascinating that a lot of the industry still don't believe that, though. They don't believe this change is coming. A lot of them genuinely believe that, you know, we're still going to be doing the things the way we've done construction for the last 20 years, 30 years, 100 years. It's not really going to change. What do you say to that?
My sense is that there's always going to be clients who go first and lead the way, and others that will follow in due course. I certainly kind of come across a number of clients who are quite clearly demanding a change in the way that their services are delivered and their outcomes are delivered. They want them to be done better, safer, cheaper, faster.
Yep.
I think the increasingly we're seeing clients drive a requirement to do things better, which in itself actually is then demanding the need to take on more technology-led or automated solutions. So I do feel as though that the clients across our industry are now actually demanding something different, because they begin to see a number of examples across the whole world of where that benefit can get delivered. And the use of BIM would just be one example I'd call out, that initially some clients pushed that forward and saw the immediate benefits coming through. Much better integration, much less sort of adversarial relationships on projects.
Okay.
And we'll see now, obviously, that the majority of major projects are delivered off a BIM platform. We're now moving forward to BIM level 2 towards more kind of digital twinning. And I think we'll see the same again, that there'll be those leaders who go first and others that follow as well. But certainly on major programs, I think we're seeing now that there's much more industrialization of these technology solutions being used.
Yeah, okay. And do you, obviously you as a business and I guess what you've seen over the years, do you feel there are certain parts of the world who are accelerating much quicker than others? You know, how do you think the UK compares, for example, to the rest of the world in terms of adoption of some of these changes?
I'd say that the UK leads in some areas, but perhaps is second or third in against some of the European countries in others. Mm-hmm. I think it's great to see the UK innovation coming through and being able to be exported, mm-hmm. particularly to other parts of the Southern Hemisphere and indeed across the pond to North America. Mm-hmm. And I think specifically around that, Paul, is around not just the use of new forms of technology, but actually how they get applied towards the delivery of valued outcomes.
Okay.
And having that mixture between really strong consulting advice and project delivery, and indeed how that gets monetized in terms of benefits.
Yes.
That is quite fresh, you know, across other parts of the world. And I think it puts UK companies in great stead going forward.
Great. Okay. I think that's my main questions now, Simon. I usually kind of close with kind of rapid fire set of questions, which don't have to be answered rapidly, but just some quicker questions. And then obviously, you know, we'll kind of close up from there, if that's okay.
That's of course, yeah.
Perfect. So as this is called Meet the Boss, who was your best ever boss in your career and why?
My best ever boss was a guy called Tim Neal, who's currently president of the RCS.
Okay.
He's a highly values-driven leader.
Okay.
High level integrity, a really strong team player who empowered his team, mm-hmm. empowered them, but also trusted them to deliver just with appropriate coaching at appropriate times. There was another guy as well who I probably put on the same pedestal, mm-hmm. Paul, a guy called David Sparrow, who is the ex-CEO of EC Harris.
Yes.
And actually had a very different style of leadership to Tim, but somebody who really kind of brought a lot of coaching and advice on an on-hands basis, so whether it's through a bid or whether it's developing a go-to-market strategy. Now, it may not have felt like kind of modern coaching at the time, but I look back at the interventions that I had with David and just see how he taught me, actually, how it's so important to put winning at the heart of your business strategy.
Okay.
And that there's a certain way of how you then determine how you go to market. So, those two characters, the one that I'd have on my list.
Okay. What would you say is the best piece of career advice that you've either ever heard or been given?
The best bit of advice I'd have is give it a go. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. Okay. No, that sounds good to me. And certainly probably, I think it's probably epitomized your career, I guess, because you probably made some, you know, pretty brave judgments to eventually leave Edinburgh in the first place, come down to Leeds and then obviously go to Dubai, which I can only imagine when you first went to Dubai was an incredibly different place to where it is now.
It was. And I think actually by having the confidence to take a leap into the unknown, take yourself out of your comfort zone and trust actually your core skills, capabilities and resilience, actually the skills that you can learn in new situations will come on that kind of the platform that you've got of how do you handle different situations and change. Skills will develop in time and then you can go off and develop new skills in due course. But I certainly kind of found the ability to enjoy those experiences as well. I quite enjoy that pressure cooker of change. And some people will embrace it, like I like to do. Others will be a bit more reticent to accept it in the first place. Others will be totally reticent. But different people, different strokes, Paul. But I certainly recommend to all your listeners to give things a shot.
Yeah, perfect. And what would you say is the worst piece of career advice you've ever been given?
Keep your head down and just stick around.
Yeah.
You'll get better soon.
Okay.
My kind of key learning over my career actually is that I I very, very much kind of see myself as a person who has strong values, and that actually, if there's an organization that you're working for that doesn't meet those values, or you feel as though are slightly disconnected, then actually staying in that organization or staying on that project or in that role just creates conflict.
Yes.
It creates stress, and nobody really wins, actually.
Yeah.
And so, the ability to spot that and spot that quite soon, I think, is important, and be confident enough to move on.
Yeah, no, spot on. I'd echo that one entirely. You know, obviously, right at the moment, speaking to a lot of individuals who probably knew, let's say, January of this year, that they were in the wrong organisation, and now that's really been confirmed to them with the behaviours of some businesses over that period of time, yet still don't want to make the jump. And I get why. Some of it's about fear of what's going on in the world. But logically, if you're not culturally aligned, you're never going to be happy, are you? You're never going to bounce out of bed every day and go to work happy.
100%, Paul. And I think, yeah, the culture of an organisation, and indeed sort of how that gets played out in clear client value propositions as well as an employee value proposition is, I think, increasingly important in any successful organisation.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And then last question, what's the best business book you've ever read?
Oh, good question. Now, you're going to get me thinking on this one, because I've actually taken to listen to more podcasts actually recently. But
Me and you both,
Yeah. There's
it could be the best podcast if you prefer.
I've actually just finished a book called Non-Bullshit Innovation by a guy called David Rowan.
Okay.
He travels across the globe in search of the most exciting and pioneering startups. So he's got to know the major technology firms quite well, WhatsApp, LinkedIn, Google, et cetera.
Okay.
And he's also looked at it from the context of what are the companies doing who are being disrupted by these big tech firms. And what he's found in this book is that there's a lot of jargon across industry. And I do liken it to the industry that we're in, Paul, that lots of talk of change agents and chief entrepreneur officers and idea portals and hackathons and paradigm shifts and so on. And what he points out actually is that a lot of it is just pointless innovation theatre, without genuine executive buy-in and actually without any kind of real change being delivered.
Yeah.
So he's putting that challenge out that to actually, it's not just about the talking, it's not just about the corporate jargon. It's about what actually happens. And so he's got some great gems of real transformative approaches to innovation. Definitely, I think it's worth a read.
I'll put that and order it, get on the power that is Amazon, and I'll put a link in the show notes as well to that.
Absolutely. Enjoy it.
Good. Thank you. Excellent. Simon, you've been very gracious with your time. I'm sure you're a busy individual. We've been going for nearly an hour now. Is there anything you'd like to kind of close with? Anything you'd like to say? I do think, you know, young professionals will find this one really, your journey really fascinating. So I do think they'll get a lot out of it.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Paul. I think certainly my sort of leading message to listeners and to taking my own experiences actually are that when you start your career, or actually when you're in different stages of your career, please don't ever think that that's it. There are many, many different options across our industry that are out there. Having been in an organization for 18 years, there was always a risk for me actually that I became quite institutionalized.
Yes.
What I've found actually when I put myself out to market was there's a lot of interest in the skill sets that I brought and to be applied in a slightly different environment. Mm-hmm. But since joining an organization such as JHD actually, there's huge value that can be delivered to that organization with the skill sets that have been brought as well. And I keep on learning. I'm learning week on week, and that never stops. And I think if you enjoy that learning and slight discomfort in some areas, I think everybody can have highly successful careers. So good luck. And Paul, many thanks for your time. Now it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
No, thank you again for your time, Simon. Have a good one. Take care.
Thank you. Bye bye.